matters of church governance and matters of church discipline are simply outside the scope of the state's power. This is an area where the church has independent authority.
The latest on an unprecedented court case designed to force priests to reveal abuse admitted to them in the confessional. The religious liberty perspective in the legal battle to protect the seal of confession.
It's the human toll and the dignity and the people's right to life, you know, that we really support fully from womb to tomb.
The right to live life without violence. Catholic faith leaders in Baltimore step up to fill a void and take action to help reduce gun violence. We are joined by the priest leading the city's gun buyback program.
When we go to adoration, we're encountering the living God, Jesus.
A recent surge in adoration hours brings joy to one Midwest diocese. How they did it with inspiration from the National Eucharistic Revival. EWTN News in Depth starts now.
Washington is one of the most unchurched states in the nation, and so there is a general feeling that the religious perspective is not always appreciated or supported.
A court case involving religious liberty in Washington state reverberates across the country in the Catholic community. Can a state force a Catholic priest to break what has always been held sacred, the seal of confession? The legal battle in Washington state has brought that question to the forefront. Welcome to EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. Catholic bishops challenging a state reporting law that would have violated the seal of confession notched at least a temporary win in federal court late last week. In a ruling blocking the measure, a U.S. district judge said there was no question the law burdened the free exercise of religion. And it all comes back to Catholic Church teaching about the confidentiality of what happens inside the confessional. Reporter Mark Irons begins our coverage.
A legal decision protecting the sacrament of confession and the constitutional First Amendment right to freedom of religion.
I certainly think the ruling is excellent news for religious liberty.
Last week, a federal court blocked a Washington state law that would have required Catholic priests to violate the confidential seal of confession and report certain things if they heard them confessed, with the threat of jail time or fines if they didn't. Attorney William Hahn, senior counsel at the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty, represented the Catholic bishops in Washington who sued the state. He described the unprecedented nature of the law.
There's not been a situation where a jurisdiction has said, you know what, we need to force the priest to go through something that would result in an automatic excommunication from the Catholic Church.
Priests cannot reveal what they hear in the sacred space of confession. They would be excommunicated or removed from the church for doing so. The Catholic position is explained in the Church Catechism. It states, the Church declares that every priest who hears confessions is bound under very severe penalties to keep absolute secrecy regarding the sins that his penitents have confessed to him. The Washington law, passed earlier this year, added clergy to a list of mandatory abuse reporters in Washington, but provided no specific exemption for what they heard in the confessional. Hahn says the court correctly recognized the law as unjust, especially as others were exempt from mandatory reporting in Washington, but not priests hearing confessions.
Washington expanded the privileges against mandatory reporting to secular professionals like attorneys or parents or caregivers. They don't have to report this kind of information. So the court was right to recognize that eliminating only the clergy's privilege showed a desire to get rid of a religiously sacrosanct practice.
We had numerous affidavits in the case from our bishops and priests saying we will violate this law because we can't possibly comply with it.
Gene Hill, the executive director of the Washington State Catholic Conference, praises the court ruling and says it was concerning when supporters of the law said the church could just change its policies.
When we confess to a priest, we're not confessing to the man sitting in front of us. We're confessing to God, who's embodied by that priest sitting in front of us. So really, the priest as a person isn't hearing what we're saying, and so he has no ability to share that beyond the confessional. And again, if he does share it beyond the confessional, then this person who's devoted their life to our church is automatically excommunicated from that vocation.
Condemnation for the law was widespread and included responses from the U.S. Department of Justice and the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. Bishop Robert Barron said if a penitent is aware the priest might, let alone must, share with others what was given in the most sacred confidence, he or she would be reluctant indeed to ever approach confession. The Confraternity of Catholic Clergy, representing priests around the world, said the Church's commitment to child protection can be lawfully and morally done without violating religious liberty. Hill said the same.
We are committed to protecting children from sexual abuse, and we are committed to protecting our right to the free exercise of our religion. Our policies require every adult who has significant unsupervised access to children to report to law enforcement if they have reasonable suspicions of abuse, and they go through regular training so they know what that looks like. And the judge actually noted that we have these policies in place and have done more to ensure protection of children.
The blocked law in Washington could be appealed by the state. Hahn provided more historical and national perspective on religious liberty and church-state relations. Citing one case that goes back to the 1800s, he said the seal of confession has been respected by U.S. law, while the church has respected and often exceeds mandatory reporting laws.
U.S. law has recovered and protected the seal of confession. It's done it in a variety of overlapping ways. And even as mandatory reporting obligations for good reasons have come into place in state laws, the church has not only had her own mandatory reporting policies that in some cases, as they do here in Washington, exceed state law, they have always been construed in harmony with the mandatory reporting policies with states.
The sacraments don't often come up in court battles, but in previous reporting, we've heard from many Catholics who depend on the grace available in confession.
I think the sacrament of confession is such a great place of renewal.
And I just feel the joy of being given that fresh start.
There's no substitute for the actual grace from the sacrament of confession.
Mark Irons, EWTN News In Depth.
Here to help us understand why the church defends the seal of confession so fiercely is one of the Washington State shepherds himself, Bishop Thomas Daly of Spokane. Your Excellency, welcome to the program. Okay, why is it so important to Catholics that the seal of confession never be broken? And what does that reveal about the meaning of the sacrament itself?
From its very beginning, from those words of Jesus when he gave to his church, those sins you will be held bound will be bound. Those that were loose or forgiven will be forgiven. I think the church for centuries, and we have very much examples in the past, whether it's the 14th century in Europe or it's in Mexico in the 19th century or in early 20th, where priests died rather than break the seal of confession.
Wow.
I think we have to understand that the seal is about that sacred bond of reuniting an individual with God's love and mercy. The priest is the good shepherd seeking the lost sheep. He is the father waiting for the prodigal son. He is the good Samaritan binding the wounds. And that is the basis of it. It's not, as I did in an interview, an intelligence gathering. It's not to frustrate the Justice Department or criminal justice. It is to bring the healing presence of God in the lives of the penitent, to reconcile that person. And the church has always seen this as sacred. In the catechism, it makes that clear in the code of canon law. So it is just from its beginning, because the goal is that the individual be reunited with God. And anything that impedes that, because, you know, some sins are very serious. That has to be protected, and the church has fought and won on that.
And there are serious consequences within the church for any priest who breaks the confessional seal. They are immediately excommunicated, isn't that right?
Yes. Yes, yes. And it would have to be, they'd have to seek to be reconciled because it is so serious. That penalty of excommunication by the code, you know, for example, and another issue most people sometimes forget, if a priest cannot forgive, if he forgives the sin of someone where a sin has been committed with a penitent, that also warrants a severe penalty. The phrase, I believe, is the gravest of penalties.
Wow. Can you explain why the confidentiality involved with confession is not the same as it is with therapy and counseling, for example?
Yeah, because of its sacramental nature. A lot of times people see that connection between a therapist and someone seeking counseling, a casual conversation between a clergy, but this is sacramental. And with that sacramental bond, it places it beyond that normal conversation that might take place between, again, a therapist or even a priest who has a conversation that is not specifically framed by the prayers of the sacrament of confession. Mm-hmm. So I think for people who aren't Catholic, they just think that it's a conversation similar to any other conversation about a serious matter.
Mm-hmm. And when people hear that priests refuse to break the seal of confession, even when someone confesses abuse, for example, they may think, well, the church is not taking the protection of minors seriously. Yeah. And frankly, Your Excellency, the church does still have a lot of work to do to repair the public's trust because of the clergy sex abuse scandal. So all that being said, the church has implemented protocols and procedures to protect minors in the church. Talk about this question that people have.
Yeah, I think people, because the church, rightfully so, did not, for various reasons, depending upon where it was, certain bishops were guilty more of moving priests. They themselves, perhaps, abused. And I think in the perception of God's people, when you harm the children, it seems a direct, and it is, it doesn't seem, it is completely ignoring those words of Jesus, what you've done for the least ones you've done to me. Mm-hmm. And I think when Jesus talks about that millstone being placed if you harm someone, that really, it just reinforces this sacred bond. So the trust, now we have in place, if anyone volunteers, teaches in a school, is part of a parish, employment, we have strict background checks and all of that. But in the people's mind, and whenever some type of abuse case comes up or things are revealed, it affects people, rightfully so, protect the most vulnerable. Mm-hmm. Now, even again, it's not just children, it's vulnerable adults. And vulnerable adults can be seminarians, it could be college students, it could be employees. And so the church has expanded that thing. But still, we do have work to do, but I think a lot of progress has been made to prevent, to the best of our ability, the situation with abuse. I think we've done far more than any other organization that works with young people.
And within the church, if someone does confess abuse, what can a priest do?
Sure. I think, again, ultimately a priest does have the right, if the individual is not remorseful, to withhold absolution. Mm. Depending upon the circumstance, depending upon how long ago it happened, depending upon there are a lot of questions that could be asked about remedy this. Perhaps the priest may say, you need to turn yourself in. The priest may say, do you know this family? If it's a family, since a lot of abuse or perhaps more abuse occurs between people who know one another, whether they're relatives or some type of close friendship. So the priest does ultimately have that, but he can, it may be something that's confessed and it happened 40 years ago in another country. Mm-hmm. What would the benefit be to because you don't want to reopen a wound and say, you must go back and say you're sorry to that person. Mm. Again, a lot of circumstances. I think a lot of, because the confessional is sacred and it's not to be broken, that seal, there's a lot of speculation as to what happens in confession. And if you talk to most priests who hear confessions in the parish, most sins are not of that nature. In fact, in my life as a priest of 38 years, I think perhaps once I heard that sin many, many years ago. And so I think an individual, we're looking to have that individual be reconciled to God, to receive his mercy and healing. But beyond that, there, it really would depend on the circumstance. So many questions. Mm.
Thank you for that clarity there. And finally, while I have you, the 3-year National Eucharistic Revival just recently came to its official close here in the U.S. And some Catholics believe for the church to cultivate a greater reverence for our Lord and the Eucharist, we first need a confession revival. What do you make of that? Can you speak to the connection that confession has to the other sacraments?
Absolutely. In my own life, as I ordained men, I said, if you want to be a good confessor, you and I have to be first penance, good penitence, which means we have to go to confession. And I think the Eucharistic revival showed the grace, the power of the Eucharist. But I do absolutely, because people unnecessarily carry around the burdens of sin, and they forget that this is a sacrament of healing. Mm-hmm. And when we confess sins, there's a peace that comes with it, and a joy. I mean, that's, you know, why is it so often those images Jesus uses about healing that comes? And people, I think if more people knew the power of the sacrament, especially the healing grace, the sanctifying grace, the sacramental grace, the ability to be unburdened by that, there would be a lot more peace and joy. Mm. I think sometimes people have bad experiences. Mm-hmm. And one of my classmates, when he spoke as Dean of Men to the students at the seminary, Father Donohue, he said, you are not there as a voyeur to question. You are there to bring the power of God's love and mercy. And the late Pope Francis really stressed that. And I think that message, when we have a great experience in confession, mm-hmm. the healing, the power, the peace, I think more people would go more frequently. Mm-hmm. It is a tremendous sacrament. Yeah.
Thank you for that reminder. And we thank you for your time this week, Bishop Daly. Thank you so much.
All right. God bless. Thank you.
Stay right there. There's much more ahead on this edition of EWTN News In Depth.
I'm Marcelle Rages in Baltimore, where the Catholic community has launched a campaign to put an end to gun violence. We'll have more for you coming up.
Next, clergy and religious who have lived for decades in a city racked by crime take action to try to bring peace to inner city neighborhoods that need a dose of love and compassion. An update on Catholic efforts to bring pastoral care, mass, and sacraments to immigrants locked up in the infamous Alligator Alcatraz Detention Center.
It's transformed their parishes in such a beautiful way.
And renewed enthusiasm for and awareness of the true presence of Christ in the Eucharist. Later, we'll take you to Mid-America to find out what one diocese is doing that could happen where you worship too. EWTN News In Depth is coming right back.
We need to be the heart on the street, and we need to be the heart of Christ present in our world. Jesus, Christ healing, Christ consoling, Christ liberating people.
Determination, resolve, and strength. The faith community steps up to fill a void in a crime-plagued area in Baltimore torn apart by gun violence. The mission is clear for clergy, religious, and laity across several Catholic congregations in Baltimore. Joined by members of other faiths, they have locked arms in the fight to provide compassion and care to crime victims and their families trapped in neighborhoods where guns and those who use them have caused way too much tragedy. Reporter Roselle Rages talked to Baltimore Catholic leaders on the front lines, trying to make a difference and to bring more awareness to the plague of gun violence.
To a parent, to a family member, to a spouse, to children whose parent is shot, you know, one is still, it's the world to them.
Sister Fran Gorsuch from the Sisters of Bon Secours has seen how gun violence has affected the community in Baltimore, a city she has lived in for more than 30 years. She recalled mourning the loss of someone who passed away while working at a preschool.
One of the boys raised his hand. He said, "Sister, who shot him?" That's all they knew of how people died, who shot him, you know, and it just kind of, it startled me for the moment. I mean, I was just shocked. When I think of the fear of parents, they can't even let their children out of the house without, you know, wondering if they're going to come back alive.
Baltimore has been one of America's most violent cities for decades. But in recent years, Baltimore has seen a decrease in gun violence and homicides. According to Baltimore Police Department's mid-year crime report, Baltimore's gun-related homicides went from 96 in 2024 to 62 in 2025, a 35% decline. While non-fatal shootings are down from 217 in 2024 to 164 in 2025, a 24% decrease. However, while the data is showing positive progress, a coalition of Baltimore-area Catholic nuns and priests worries that the number of gun violence victims will be on the rise again after major funding cuts. In April, under the Trump administration, the Department of Justice canceled more than 360 ongoing grants, totaling more than $800 million for community violence intervention work. In response, the Sisters of Bon Secours, along with seven other congregations, launched a campaign to raise awareness about gun violence in the city.
40 buses have the signage, "Put the guns down, let peace begin with us," both inside and outside. It also has a QR code that leads to the campaign's website.
There's a QR code on the bus that you can click on and get more information, because we can also advocate through legislation, because some of the federal budget cuts are going to influence some of the funding and programs that Baltimore has had in place in recent years to decrease gun violence.
Sister Mary Jo Stein from the Daughters of Charity is no stranger to Baltimore either. She was born just outside of the city, and after spending years away from ministry, she is now back in Baltimore working as a nurse practitioner.
In the clinic where I work now, some of our patients come in suffering the trauma of having witnessed someone in their family die. So there's all the facets of areas where we work. We see the effects of gun violence, so we want to do something proactive.
For Father Mike Murphy, who grew up in Baltimore and currently lives in one of Baltimore's more dangerous neighborhoods, the cause is personal.
There's been numerous loss of life through gun violence in this neighborhood. At the bottom of the street here, my first year here as a pastor, in the middle of the Christmas Eve Mass, a man was murdered at the bottom of the street. I think you get tired of the violence, and you get tired of, you know, nothing seemed to be changing.
In 2023, he organized an interfaith community prayer service in the city. Faith leaders and other community organizers met at St. Joseph's Monastery Parish at the end of the year for the service, followed by a prayer walk through the streets.
As we walk, we stop along the way and we read the names, keep reading the names of those who have died till we get to the end. And you know, to speak their name and to remember them is very valuable, and to allow their loved ones to come and to participate in that walk and to hear their loved ones' names spoken, and that it meant something, they're not forgotten.
In the same year, Father Mike with the Archdiocese of Baltimore launched a gun buyback program in an effort to reduce the number of weapons on the street. In the 2 years they have hosted the event, church officials obtained nearly 650 weapons and raised $70,000 to buy back the guns, with remaining funds going to the Archdiocesan's grief ministry.
Well, I wish it could stop. I wish I didn't have to hold and hug another mother.
There are Baltimore residents like Darlene Kane, who lost her son Dale Graham to a police shooting, who are now advocates for stopping gun violence. To help her community grieve the loss of their loved ones, she collects what she calls soul boxes.
They were like paper boxes made by hand that look like jewelry boxes, and it's for your loved one. And the person could be someone that lost their life to gun violence, injured, or someone who lost their life to suicide.
Darlene brings these soul boxes and puts them on display to any event she's a part of, as she continues to push for safer gun laws and fewer illegal guns on the streets. She tells us what her hopes are for the future.
That there will be more education, more resources, more reforms for gun laws. I just love to see the kids playing again, just being safe like we used to, jump and rope and hold hands and jump in circles, and parents not feeling like when you go to the corner store, it's a dangerous thing to do.
Rosal Regis, EWTN News in Depth.
And joining us now in studio is Father Mike Murphy, pastor of St. Joseph's Monastery Parish in Southwest Baltimore and one of the lead organizers of the Archdiocese's Gun Buyback Program. Father, thanks so much for being here with us on this critical issue. And as you stated so eloquently in Roselle's report, this issue is a personal one for you.
It's very personal. You know, the 30 years I've worked in that community, where I actually grew up myself, there's been numerous killings right on the main strip. The person that was killed on Christmas Eve my first year there, mm-hmm. 2 weeks ago in that very same corner, another person was murdered within the last 2 weeks. And so it's constant, either the non-fatal or the fatal. The constant sound of, you know, sirens or helicopters hovering over, it's just a tragic, tragic loss. It doesn't need to be this way.
And the fact that happened your first year, that's formative. That must have been formative for your priestly ministry.
It was, you know, in the church full of Christmas Eve folks. But I couldn't help thinking about the family who was going to get that phone call in a short while after the police would find out who it was. How tragically their lives would be changed forever, you know.
And there are a number of media portrayals of the city of Baltimore mm-hmm. in particular, maybe most famously in The Wire, for example. Mm. But as an actual longtime resident and community leader in Baltimore, can you shed more insight into the gun culture there? Tell us about that.
There does seem to be access to weapons that a certain population has access to. And I understand there is some sort of way to obtain weapons very easily. Someone once told me you can go to a corner to get a pack of cigarettes and you're going to get a gun just as easily on another corner. You know, so it's a culture that I don't know much about or invested myself in, but I know it's there. I've heard people talk of it. I've talked to people who work in the city, and it's very easy to obtain a weapon. So there is that constant flow, I think, of weapons into people's hands.
And Baltimore has had this long reputation for being one of the deadliest homicide rates in the nation. But this year, the city is experiencing the fewest homicides in 50 years. And it seems like Baltimore leaders are scrambling to take credit or point to different reasons for why that is. What's your reaction to this drop in the homicide rate and your thoughts on that?
I think it's a little bit of everything. I mean, the mayor has been committed to creating, you know, ways to help people solve issues in a nonviolent way. Some of those programs may be in jeopardy because of the budget cuts, but, you know, those in cooperation with people and individual communities doing their part, the gun buyback, to continually have this as part of the ongoing conversation. And for us, this is not a once-a-year thing. It's a continuing conversation about we can be better, we can be more peaceful, and being visible in a way to tell people that there's a different way. And I never underestimate the power of prayer, you know.
Absolutely. And the third annual gun buyback program is coming up on August 9th. As you've launched this program, what's surprised you the most about it?
Well, I think I learned, you know, things of people who don't believe in it. Mm. And some of them I'm really surprised at. Mm. You know, some of them are other priests. And other people who have a negative view about do these work? Is it a proper way of using funds? You know, so I don't engage those arguments or discussions because I know that any weapon out of somebody's home is going to prevent maybe a suicide or a domestic violence. Any gun that can be stolen and used in a crime. And trying to reach out to that population who do have weapons for doing not good, trying to continue to touch their hearts, but we have to consistently be present. So the prayer service that we have every December is a follow-up to the gun buyback and trying to find other ways for the church constantly to be visible and present.
Well, you hit on the next question that I had for you, which is that this topic of guns and the Second Amendment, it is one of the most heated and debated topics in our nation, and there are a diversity of opinions by Catholics and in the Catholic Church as well. But do you think this is an issue the church should be vocal on?
On the gun violence, yes. I mean, I think the Second Amendment, you know, is people's rights, you know. Mm-hmm. I don't question that. You know, people are responsible. They keep their weapons locked up out of the hands of children, which we've had some recent occasions where there's been accidental shootings because it wasn't secured. Mm. So people are responsible and, they keep their weapons secure and it's used for good purposes. I have no argument with that.
But when it comes to gun violence.
Yeah.
And you see this as a dignity of life issue.
It certainly is a dignity and quality of life issue that people, across the board, there's so many vulnerable people. And the area that will have the buyback this year is a little bit more of an area that's much more vulnerable to these kinds of poverty, drugs, gun violence, housing issues. It's a much more area with a lot more needs and attention than we previously had it. But when I go down to that, to the shopping center, we're going to have it, and just the sadness of those people's lives. Mm. And the first year we did the gun buyback, there was the money that we don't use. Mm-hmm. It goes through our Archdiocese and Grief Ministry Program, which helps families bury their loved one, and no one is ready to do that. Helps people with food or housing or sometimes relocation. So the very first year, we actually helped a mother bury her son, mm-hmm. who was murdered outside her home with his girlfriend early in the morning. Mm-hmm.
Tell us more about this, Father, because, again, this has been something that seems like it's been a part of your entire priesthood. How do you even begin to minister to families who have lost a loved one to gun violence?
Mm-hmm. It's to be present and to know that they're not alone. A lot of those families are in very vulnerable positions. In their relationships with their family, all kinds of difficulties that any family faces. But some of these families are living in some really difficult situations and vulnerability. And you walk into this and you realize just how do people weather this without support? How do you find money to bury your child? How do you move to the next day and worry about food and housing or location when your mind has been totally blown in by the sense of this loss. So it's being present and showing up and not going away after a day, a month, but continuously to be present and to do these things, and how we can continue to do things to keep this conversation of creating a culture, a better culture of peace in our city.
And ultimately, this buyback program that you've helped launch, you hope to bring more peace and healing
yes.
to the city.
Absolutely. This year we've raised, about a little over $60,000. We have each year build a list of really great supporters, parishes, religious communities, individuals who don't even live in the city who believe in this. Mm-hmm. And we don't make it a political argument because people will try to take it there. Mm-hmm. The police have been wonderfully supportive. Mm-hmm. They're there to facilitate and to collect the weapons. The diocese, Archdiocese, is very supportive and using all their resources to help promote it and pull it together. So it really is a great collaborative of a statement of peace and of love, and that we're here.
Mm. Father Mike Murphy, thank you for driving into D.C.
Sure.
to be with us this week. We appreciate it.
I'm glad to. Thank you.
Thank you. If you would like more information about this important issue, take note of these two websites. Go to bondsecure.us for information on the Put the Guns Down campaign, or the Archdiocese of Baltimore's website at archbalt.org for details about the gun buyback program. And our thanks to in-depth reporter Roselle Rages, who completed her report on this important issue just in the nick of time. After working a full day last Friday, just hours later last weekend, she and her husband welcomed a new family member into the world. Here's Isaiah Lucas, all 6 pounds and 11 ounces of him, with his mother looking as beautiful as ever, of course. Isaiah joins his three big brothers. Oh boy, indeed. A busy household with some proud parents. Let's keep our Roselle and family in prayer as they get used to being a household of six now. Our congratulations to the entire Regis family. Up next on EWTN News in Depth, we get serious again with top headlines in the week in review: Gaza, Syria, and a leading Catholic voice on Christian persecution, right after this. Growing concern about the increasing humanitarian crisis in Gaza tops the week in review. This week, 28 countries, including Britain, Japan, Australia, and Canada, called for an immediate end to the war there. In a joint statement, they condemned the suffering of civilians, limited aid access, dangerous levels of starvation and malnutrition, and recent deaths of a reported 800 Palestinians while in designated distribution areas seeking food and water. The statement says Israel's aid delivery model is dangerous and violates international humanitarian law.
The war in Gaza must end now. There is no military solution. Negotiations will secure the hostages. Further bloodshed serves no purpose. Hamas and Israel must both commit to a ceasefire now, and the next ceasefire must be the last ceasefire.
Despite the global claims, Israel Defense Forces say there is no famine in Gaza as of yet. An Israeli government spokesman says it is a man-made shortage engineered by Hamas and blamed the United Nations for withholding aid. In the meantime, Israeli tanks have entered Deir al-Bala area in central Gaza, a place not previously targeted in ground operations. Israel Army Radio says only one brigade is involved so far, and the operation may last several weeks. The Israeli Defense Forces have ordered evacuations and dropped leaflets warning civilians. Hostage families are demanding answers from the government. They fear this move could endanger the hostages, who many believe might be held in the area. An update now on that Israeli tank strike late last week on the only Catholic church in Gaza. After a swift investigation, the Israeli military released the official findings of its probe into the accident. Confirming what was initially announced last week, the report said the Holy Family Church compound was unintentionally hit with misfired munitions. The Army says adjustments have been made to improve the accuracy of fire and guidelines for conducting operations near religious sites have been clarified. Three people were killed in the incident and several others injured, including parish priest Gabriel Romanelli, who on Thursday spoke to EWTN Noticias, our Spanish language news program, about what happened that day.
We had recently suspended outdoor activities because many shrapnel pieces fell and the bombings were very close, though paradoxically, no particular bombing was going on that day. We never imagined that the church would be hit. Thank God we had suspended outdoor activities like games, youth group meetings, family gatherings, and folklore events used to lighten the life here. It has been almost 2 years that people have lived with us here. It was truly a tragedy, but thank God the adolescents and the adoration group weren't in the courtyard then. The explosion occurred around 10 a.m. after our morning prayers.
Father Romanelli says while the war continues, he asks, indeed begs, for humanitarian aid to be allowed in. He said the population is suffering and needs absolutely everything, from food to water to medicine to everyday living supplies. A warning from the United Nations as sectarian violence rages on in southern Syria, despite a ceasefire declared by interim President Ahmed al-Shara. Druze fighters reportedly expelled Bedouin gunmen from the city of Shweida, but clashes persist across the province. More than 900 people have died, with atrocities reported on all sides. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio condemned the violence while Israel struck Syrian targets in support of the Druze. The United Nations warns of grave human rights abuses and is calling for an immediate end to the bloodshed. It says the alleged perpetrators include security forces and individuals affiliated with the interim government, as well as Druze and Bedouin fighters. This comes as Christian communities in Syria continue to experience escalating violence. On July 15th, the historic St. Michael Church was vandalized and set ablaze in Shweida. Its altar was desecrated. In the same region, 38 Christian homes were reportedly destroyed, forcing dozens to seek shelter in a church hall. In a separate incident last month, at least 22 people were killed and 63 others injured in the attack that took place at the St. Elias Church, located on the outskirts of Damascus. The Syrian Catholic Archbishop of Homs in Syria is calling for the protection of the Christian presence in the war-torn country. Despite the chaos, he says Jesus wants his church to remain in Syria. To discuss the dire situation for Christians in Syria, We are joined by Bishop Francois Beyrouti. He is the leader of the Melkite Greek Catholic Church in the United States, an Eastern Rite that's in full communion with Rome and is headquartered in Damascus, Syria. Born in Lebanon, Bishop Beyrouti has been leading the more than 20,000 Melkites in the U.S. since 2022. Your Excellency, thanks for being back with us. First, what are you hearing from Christian leaders on the ground in Syria amid this new wave of violence? And why are attacks against Christians in Syria especially concerning?
Thank you, Catherine, for welcoming me back on EWTN and for your voicing the concerns of the Christians in the Middle East and also throughout the world. What we are hearing is that the Christians there are fearful because they're living through a lot of uncertainty at this point. And there was hope with the transition to the new regime that perhaps there would be greater respect for the minorities, but perhaps that hope has been a little bit unrealistic because of the nature of the conflict that has been ongoing for several years. The Christian community remains, especially our Melkite Catholic community that, as you mentioned, is, our patriarch is in Damascus, but we trace our ancient roots to Antioch, Acts chapter 11, where in Antioch, the followers of Christ were first called Christians. Mm-hmm. So our communities there have been living there for 2,000 years, both providing spiritual but also social stability in the country.
You issued a pastoral letter following the attack on the St. Elias Greek Orthodox Church in Damascus in late June. How did you react when you heard about that attack, Your Excellency? And what is the message that you wanted to convey in this pastoral letter?
Two things. First, you know, we hear things on the news and we're very shocked to hear, first of all, an explosion in a church or an attack on a church as people are worshiping. Second, for myself, there are very personal elements of this because we have parishioners here in the United States that have family members who died in the attack. And I was in Chicago that weekend or a few days after the attack, and I met personally with family members who had cousins and relatives who died in the attack and then went back to Boston and had another memorial service, and in Los Angeles here had another memorial service. So it was not only just a news piece on the, but also very personal for us because we saw firsthand that real people and real lives were affected and lives that we knew. Mm-hmm. In one case, it was a young girl who was a medical student who was going to church to pray before her exams. And unfortunately, she did not walk out alive. Mm. And so the message that I sent was a message of hope that, first of all, the Christians there, the Catholic communities, the Melkite Catholic community, and the Orthodox community are united in prayer. We belong to the same Patriarchate of Antioch. We celebrate the same Byzantine liturgy. And so we have a common heritage with intermarriage in a variety of ways, not only in Damascus and other parts of the Middle East. So there is a common friendship that is there naturally. But also, we wanted to show that this wasn't just somebody who died by accident. They were specifically targeted because of their faith. And these situations, when they happen, they aren't only attacking a church or a particular individual. They're sending a message of instability that they want people to have a sense of fear.
Your Excellency, I spoke with you last in late 2024 following the fall of the Assad regime in Syria. And as you mentioned at the time, there was optimism and hope about the path forward for Christianity. Can you just give us more context? What has happened between now and then?
I think sometimes we're a little naive that a country that has been destabilized and rebels have been able to operate without any kind of oversight or any kind of unity, societal unity, that all of a sudden with a new leader, regardless of how respected or disregarded he is, mm-hmm. that all of a sudden that will change overnight. And I think that's a big element that Western countries on a political front, that to assist not only in like prayer for all of the Catholic communities, but mm-hmm. on a political front to assist in creating a stable environment, whatever that means politically.
Is that what you'd like to see come from the Trump administration and helping to facilitate that peace and stability? President Trump met with Syria's new president, Ahmad al-Sharaa, during a visit to Saudi Arabia in what was considered a watershed moment back in May.
Yes, I would encourage all those not only in the Trump administration but also worldwide, to see everyone as a human and not just see a political angle to this. Yes, there are political angles of alliances and friendships and all sorts of things that we talk about with interests, international interests, but also never to forget that we are dealing with humans. We are dealing with fathers and mothers. We are dealing with children that are just like our own.
Finally, Pope Leo XIV, he expressed his closeness to the persecuted Christians in the region following the terrorist attack in Damascus. So while it is still early in his pontificate, it does seem that Pope Leo wants to be a peacemaker pope globally. Do you expect he will help to facilitate peace in Syria? And how might he do that?
Yes, thank you for that great question. I was very blessed to attend both the funeral of Pope Francis and also met Pope Leo only 5 days after his election. And we were very touched. He had a special audience with all the Eastern Catholic churches and expressed such close unity with all the churches, not only those who were there, but also recognized the historic nature of the Eastern Catholic churches. Pope Leo, he has made it very clear, not only on this front, but also on the question of Ukraine, mm-hmm. that the Vatican wants to be at the forefront of negotiations, mm-hmm. wants to provide a forum for all world leaders to negotiate peace. And as we know, as Catholics, we always want to advocate for peace, not war, for stability, not instability, for truth, not violence.
Absolutely. Bishop Francois Beirouti, thank you so much for your time. And we join our prayers with yours for our brothers and sisters in Syria. Thank you. A continued drawdown this week of U.S. military forces deployed to Los Angeles during protests of the Trump administration's immigration policies. The Pentagon has ordered active duty Marines return to their California base after more than a month. Roughly 700 Marines were sent to Los Angeles in early June to join 4,000 troops from the National Guard. Pentagon officials praised the Marines' role in restoring order to the city in the withdrawal announcement. In the meantime, about 2,000 National Guard troops assigned to the Federal Protection Mission remain deployed. California Governor Gavin Newsom is calling for a full withdrawal of the remaining forces, saying local law enforcement never needed the military to get the situation under control, and that calling in federal troops was nothing but political theater. An update now on another contentious immigration story we told you about last week. This one, the detention of thousands of immigrants in cage-like facilities at Alligator Alcatraz, a facility in the Florida Everglades. According to officials in the Archdiocese of Miami, the detainees are still not receiving pastoral care, even though most come from historically Catholic countries. Archbishop Thomas Wenske told us last week that he and Bishop Frank DeWayne of the Venice, Florida Diocese approached both federal and state officials, including the Florida State Attorney General's office, asking for permission to say Mass and to provide sacraments to the men. There is still no movement on their request. EWTN News in Depth also contacted the Florida Attorney General's office about the matter. The official on the record response was no comment. On Friday, Governor Ron DeSantis announced deportation flights of detainees out of the facility to other countries has begun. In the meantime, the Harley-Davidson riding Archbishop Wenske got as close as he could last weekend to Alligator Alcatraz. He and 25 other members of his Knights on Bikes Club rode to the entrance of the detention center on Sunday afternoon, where they prayed a rosary for the detainees. That's as far as Archbishop Wenske and his group of Catholic bikers were allowed to go without approval from officials. Knights on Bikes is a charitable ministry within the Knights of Columbus. The Miami Archdiocese called their visit to the Everglades facility a powerful moment of prayerful solidarity in support of those being held there. There is much more ahead. Next, right after the break, a worship boom in the American heartland.
Here in the Diocese of Salina, adoration hours are skyrocketing due to a diocese-wide campaign to boost time in prayer before the Eucharist. I'm Alan Holdren in Salina, Kansas. That story coming up.
A It was 1 year ago this month, more than 50,000 Catholics descended onto Indianapolis to take part in a joyous celebration of the real presence of Christ at the 10th National Eucharistic Congress. The event drew together Catholics of all ages from all corners of the United States to reinvigorate their devotion to the Eucharist, the source and summit of our faith. The multi-day event consisted of seminars, fellowship, music, adoration, and mass. The Congress was just one large element of a three-year Eucharistic revival in the U.S., which came to an official conclusion in Los Angeles in June. But the goal of the revival is a long-lasting one, one that places hope in reinvigorated clergy and laity to maintain the energy and embrace of our Lord at new levels of enthusiasm and reverence. In fact, the Eucharistic revival has spurred on grassroots initiatives around the country that are doing just that. From America's heartland, reporter Alan Holdren tells us about one diocese which has been inspired to promote its own program called Adoration for Peace.
Praying for peace in adoration. That was at the root of a 3.5-month-long campaign in the Diocese of Salina, Kansas, with the goal of increasing adoration hours in every one of its 86 parishes.
It's not necessarily about achieving 24/7 or perpetual adoration or whatever a given amount is for a parish. It's to personally invite everybody in the parish to start a regular prayer life in Eucharistic adoration.
Andrew Niewald is the president of the Adoratio Foundation, based in Beloit, Kansas. Adoratio ran the Adoration for Peace campaign in the Salina Diocese. After participating in the National Eucharistic Congress in Indianapolis last summer, the foundation wanted to capitalize on the momentum to build adoration locally during this final year of the Eucharistic revival. Their research showed that on average, just 3-7% of people who participate in parish life participate in adoration.
We wanted to heighten that number. And so going through a spiritual campaign that puts an intense focus on Eucharistic adoration, Eucharistic teaching designed to develop a devotion to the Eucharist.
Be pleased to bless.
With the blessing of Salina's bishop, they identified and brought together adoration coordinators to represent each parish of this vast rural Kansas diocese. So this year, starting on Ash Wednesday and ending on the Feast of Corpus Christi, with these volunteers on the ground, they increased the total number of Eucharistic adorers and holy hours across the diocese.
Blessed be God and his angels.
To me, it's all like a great ending of our three-year Eucharistic revival in the United States. And I just, you know, think that this is brings it down more to a personal level.
32 Salina Diocese parishes that didn't offer adoration now do. 34 parishes expanded their existing hours. 500 more weekly holy hours are now being prayed. That's 26,000 more holy hours a year. Here at Salina's diocesan offices, Bishop Gerald Vinke, who prays a holy hour before the Blessed Sacrament every morning, has seen a change.
It's amazing what's happening in our diocese. You know, we try so many things to evangelize, and really the most important thing is really Eucharistic adoration, because hearts are transformed. This is what we really need in our whole country, in the world, really, is for people to pray.
From the chancery to the churches, like Salina's Sacred Heart Cathedral, the concerted effort to increase participation in Eucharistic adoration across the diocese is bearing fruit.
According to parishioners at the cathedral, it's given them a needed boost.
For me, it's just been really exciting. There's just a little bit of a buzz and a maybe an attention to it now that we haven't seen in a while.
In the community, people are becoming more and more aware and attending, signing up for the adoration hours, and even substituting. Sometimes it was so hard to get a substitute for your hour.
Across town at St. Elizabeth Ann Seton Parish, where they have perpetual adoration, Pastor Father Keith Weber has been impressed by the changes he has seen.
As I walk by the chapel throughout the day, I can see that there's up to 10 to 15 people in there praying, which rarely happened before this campaign.
The hour of adoration is just a small commitment time-wise, but adorers say it changes them and their communities.
I think that it makes the virtues of God grow within our own diocese. It opens up a new light because those people who are so attuned to the Blessed Sacrament, their light will be Christ's light.
Mona Mars brings her grandchildren with her several times a month, passing the torch to a new generation.
I just like praying with Jesus, and I normally just like listen to what he has to say to me.
And as adoration grows here in Salina, the hope is that this campaign will outgrow the diocese and spread across the nation and world, like a prairie fire from the heartland of the United States. In Salina, Kansas, Alan Holdren, EWTN News in Depth.
The Adoratio Foundation and Salina Diocese have teamed up with the International Our Lady of Peace community based in Europe to encourage adoration across North America. Visit starsofpeace.org for more information on how your parish can get support in expanding its adoration time. A big event is coming up next week in Rome as the highly anticipated Jubilee of Youth is about to kick off. A preview right after this break. Finally today, we invite you from the comfort of your home or the convenience of your mobile device to join EWTN for one of the most highly anticipated jubilees of this jubilee year. The Holy See calls the event one of the most important moments of the Holy Year when the Jubilee of Youth begins next Tuesday with a mass of welcome in St. Peter's Square, emphasizing the next generation of Catholics who will take Catholicism into the future. The Jubilee lasts through next Sunday, and large numbers of pilgrims are expected. Officials this week, including the mayor of Rome, said the city is ready to welcome the world.
Il Giubileo dei Giovani.
The Jubilee of Youth represents the most eagerly awaited moment of the Holy Year because it's the one with the highest number of participants. Pilgrims come from 146 different countries. 68% comes from Europe and the rest from other continents. Special mention should be made of the young people coming from war zones, Lebanon, Iraq, Myanmar, Ukraine, Israel, Syria, and South Sudan. This is an example of an embrace that includes the new generations from all over the world.
EWTN will be providing live coverage all next week of the Jubilee of Youth. I am pleased to be anchoring the coverage with my co-host, Father Aquinas Gilbo, chaplain and director of campus ministry at the Catholic University of America. Check out EWTN.com for a program guide to our extensive live coverage, beginning with a preview of the Jubilee of Youth next Tuesday and the televised Mass with additional coverage through Sunday. We hope you'll join us. And next week at this time, this program will also focus on this Jubilee year of 2025 with special reports on the Jubilee theme of Pilgrims of Hope. And that's it for this edition of EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. Until we see you again, God bless.